listening to Not So Live from Asteroid Z, presenting from a weird island training camp that no one asked for. I'm your host, Mike Finkelstein.
Your buddy Mike the Ghoul here, gonna hench his way about as best henchman can here as we're back on the 60s Bond henchman train today.
This is completely unrelated, but I wrote like the first couple pages for a script about a henchman and I called it Hench. And it never went anywhere, but I loved the name of that script. So, yeah. Okay. We are going to be discussing Bond movies. We're into movies 2 and 3 for a very specific reason we will get to. But before we do that, we would like to thank this week's sponsor, Spectre. If you have a job that needs specialized experience, contact Spectre. Their team of qualified professional contractors can handle any task you may have, from construction to demolitions, espionage to pet care. Spectre knows how to handle your business. They work internationally, and no job is too big or too small. From the first mission to the last, Spectre is there for you. So, the two movies we reviewed this time around were From Russia with Love, the second Sean Connery, and Goldfinger, the third Sean Connery. And the thing I will say is that it definitely feels like across these three movies that we've watched so far, including Dr. No, the series is desperately trying to find itself.
Yeah, it does not know what it is just yet. It doesn't.
Not at all. Not in the slightest. It has an idea of like, okay, we need to get a formula down. We need to do specific things. But it doesn't know what that formula is supposed to be yet. And you feel that most strongly in From Russia with Love, which is a movie that honestly doesn't even need James Bond in it. It's like he's just kind of there and shit happens.
Yeah, and they give you the fake out very early on in this movie, thinking that they kill him off in the first, like, 5 minutes. And then it's like, oh, wait, no, we can't do that. This is a person in a mask, and this is a training compound. Like, all right, this is kind of goofy, but I'm here for it, I guess.
Yeah, so the plot is that the MI6 wants a Lecter, which is some MacGuffin. Like, they don't even really define exactly what it is that they want. I kept
something
hearing
about coding and decodes. Like, I don't know. I think cryptology, I guess.
I kept hearing lectern because that's one of those, like, portable, like, machines you just set up and have as a podium. And I'm like, anyone can buy that at a Radio Shack, guys. Why the fuck are you trying to go get one from, like, Russia? But anyway, Russia has a lector, quote unquote. I'm not even sure if we're saying that right, but that's what it sounded like.
We're going to go with that this time.
And MI6 has a girl on the inside who wants to defect, quote unquote, and pass the lector off to them, and James Bond is sent in to get it. In the meantime, we actually learn, before James Bond even comes into the story, that it's actually Spectre, agents number 3 and number 5, reporting to number 1, who we eventually learn in a future movie is Blofeld. They want the lector, and they want to use MI6 to get it away from the Russians and steal it for themselves. This is the plot. And so, for 15 minutes, James Bond isn't even in his own movie. It's a fake-out, and then we focus on Spectre, and we learn about their agents and everything else. And then when he finally shows up, it takes about another hour before he does anything useful in his own story.
It's really true. Like, it is. It's a lot of exposition early on, and you get, again, this is the Austin Powers formula from the 90s, 2000s, grabbing from this with the numbered agents here, number 3, number 5, and, you know, and I was saying that, like, even, like, you know, Bond has evolved a lot, and we're getting there, but, like, there's a lot of, like, still just misogyny and rapiness in these movies that are rather uncomfortable 60 years later.
Both of these were really bad for different reasons, but I feel bad for the Bond girl in this one, the Russian girl, because she gets abused a lot, and she basically has no agency of herself. Spectre brings her in because she's supposed to, quote-unquote, defect, except she's not defecting, she's actually a loyal Russian. But because of the actions of Spectre, she now has to defect after she learns what's going on. And then she comes with James Bond, who she instantly falls in love with for, let's be honest, no reason whatsoever. And then he abuses, at times physically, the absolute ever-loving shit out of her.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, when they're on the train and everything, and, like, I know they're supposed to, like, whatever, but
it's bad. It's real so bad. So Bond gets brought in by MI6. He goes to Turkey. The Turkish consulate for MI6 handles most of the stuff up to a point. And then they end up on a train. And that's where James Bond really starts to take over his own story, is on the big train set piece. But even then, it's just like, well, we're on a train. Stuff happens. He doesn't do espionage. He doesn't really blend in. He doesn't use secret identities. He doesn't do a mystery. He doesn't investigate. It's just Bond wandering around while shit happens to him, and then suddenly he wins.
Yeah, the bad guy gets on the train at some point and kills the person he's on the train with, and they still have to go a very large distance
Yeah.
with the guy dead. I'm like, okay, so where's the bad guy? And if he was able to kill these two guys, or why hasn't he done something already? Why are we
Yeah.
waiting around here? And like, the bad guy in this is played by Robert Shaw, and I love Robert Shaw, one of my favorite actors from this time period, and he was pretty decent as the villain. When he speaks at the end of the movie and he's talking, he really, like, if you know Robert Shaw from Jaws, you almost see that character of Quint here a little bit in his mannerisms and everything, but he's not the gruff fisherman in this.
Yeah, he's very different.
He's very different. Blonde hair, like almost Adonis looking, like a physically imposing force is what he looks like. And Robert Shaw was big in this movie. I'll give him that. He looked pretty svelte. And then the fight is fine. We get some good gadgets that Q gave him. We did see Q in this movie for the first time.
Shows
He
up for the
shows
first
up,
time. Yep.
gives him a bunch of shit in a briefcase that kind of helps along the way.
It's
But
the
I
most
mean,
mundane collection of gadgets Bond will ever get. It almost instantly in the next movie they one up themselves. But this is like you get a knife that pops out, or if you open the case wrong, a gas canister bursts. And I'm like, well, this is actually real espionage stuff here, and why is it in this movie when this movie doesn't deserve it?
yeah, there's no
No.
spy shit going on here.
No. 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 So I have some notes, and I know you have some notes. We'll see how they
Yes.
line up, but we get a far more traditional opening here with the sexy dancing girls and a theme song
Yes.
written for the movie. Mostly it
Yes.
plays at the end, but we do at least get a theme here, and it's not the James Bond theme throughout all of it.
It's not that
Not
true
quite.
title yet that we've
Yeah.
grown accustomed to, but it's getting there.
Yeah. This is also
Yeah.
the second of three movies directed by Terrence Young, who also directed Dr. No, and it feels rough. It feels like he has a vision for this that the movies aren't really suited for. And someone else directs Goldfinger, and I think they do a much better job with the material. Terrence Young, I feel, is just not suited to these movies. Blofeld finally shows up here for the first time, petting his cat, although he has hair. He's not bald, and we don't see his face. It reminds me, honestly, because we see the back of his head, and then we see the hand on the cat. It reminds me of Claw from Inspector Gadget.
Very much Dr.
Yes,
Claw,
Dr.
yes.
Claw. We talked about the fact that the opening of the first movie had Baccarat for James Bond. The villains here are introduced at a giant chess match, like very luxurious chess match, which I know chess is still a thing. There are still grandmasters, they still play, but we don't get the kinds of like international broadcasts with this level of luxury that this chess match used to get, or like these kinds of things used to get back in the day. I also thought about that when I watched The Queen's Gambit, that Netflix show, which again, a lot of opulence for chess, and I don't know if that's just not an American thing at this point that we don't really care, or if it's more that this was a very 1960s thing and we've all just kind of moved on.
It feels like they're still trying to hit on that, like, upper crust society kind of
Yes,
thing, like the
yes.
background. Your average person doesn't play baccarat. Your average person doesn't play chess,
No.
especially in a setting where there's this giant board that they're moving the pieces with, like these wooden handles, and the crowd, a hush falls over the crowd when Queen takes Rook three, like kind of the ooh, like. Chess is a brilliant game. It's been around for centuries. It's a tough game to play. It's even harder to master. I'm not shitting on that, but like this is not something that you're gonna see nowadays.
Yeah. You touched upon the fact that Austin Powers definitely stole the idea of the numbered agents. And on that same front, number three really reminds me of Frau Farbissina.
A
Just
hundred
the
percent.
two, including the implied lesbianism that they couldn't actually have in the 1960s, that Austin Powers just triple underlined. Like they could get away with it then, so they totally doubled down on it. But it works. Spectre Island is cartoonish and stupid.
Oh man, we both kind of love this, right? The walkthrough there with like the goofy guys shooting the machine guns on one side, other guys crawling under like trip wires on the other, like
Yeah.
people stabbing like
What is this?
scarecrows with medieval knives and shit. Like it's like, and Frau Farbissina, number three, is walking by like, training looks very good, and they're like, yes, we set everything up great for you today. Like it's so goofy, but
It's so
like.
dumb. It doesn't like it's again the movie doesn't know what it wants to be. It's all over the place with its style and its tone and its execution. Like later on, we get James Bond getting dragged to a Romani camp to just watch them dance for 5 minutes and have a fight. And you're like, why is this even in this movie? It does nothing for the plot at all.
No. They're trying to set up some kind of like cultural thing and like show that, like, you know, the how the gypsies and the Turks behave, and like there's this, all it was how can we get James alone with two girls to get him laid?
Yeah.
That's kind of what it felt like.
And that it has no bearing on the plot whatsoever, which is a lot of what happens in this movie. Stuff just happens, but it has no bearing. Tatiana Romanoff, the girl, is introduced as the loyal Russian and to be a honey trap for Bond. And then the second, like, they sleep together, once that plot line's thrown away and she's just his Bond girl, and we forget all about everything else.
It's getting better. You can see them start to figure things out. They refine things much more in the next movie. But, like, this is... Dr. No was better at points than this, and this movie wasn't good either.
No,
like, they still haven't got it yet. And again, a critical success, I guess you'd say, because $2 million budget, $79 million in sales at the time. Like, people still came out to see it. And Connery, I'm sure, had that staying power, like, as Bond, and he got better and better as he went. But, like, I mean, this was not a successful sophomore follow-up, I think, in my opinion.
No, it's like they knew they had to do a much better ending because they biffed the ending on the first movie. So they put all their focus on that train sequence that was going to be their climactic finish. And then it's just kind of like they wrote themselves towards that train and didn't have anything. So this one's like one really good last act, but two shitty first acts. Whereas Dr. No was two really good first acts and a shitty last act.
Yeah. And the whole gypsy thing in the middle, like, for the plot, like, all it did was pad 10 minutes into a runtime of an already movie that wasn't super long to begin with. Like, it just made no sense. Like, you know, I didn't give a shit about Karim Bey. Like, he just seemed like a creepy fucking Arab guy. Like, you know, supposed to be this connection Bond has, and then he dies real fast or whatever on the train ride. And he's got a, like, he lets his sons know, like, you know, your father's dead, and like, you know, this whole family dynamic, apparently, that doesn't mean anything anymore.
Man, and like, nope, it's gone. We're just going to toss that aside because we don't need him anymore.
There's a lot of, like, Cold War cherry picking going on here, it feels like.
You could distill this entire first hour 15 of this movie to James just shows up in Turkey, immediately meets Tatiana, and he's like, oh, you have the lector. I was sent here for that. Let's go. And then you ditch all the rest of the plot, and then you just get on the train. And then this is 40 minutes of actual movie. Maybe an hour. Yeah.
You know, you can expand. You know, here's an idea. Maybe not, instead of this 10-minute belly dancing scene, we get a little bit more about the villain, who has disappeared for just large portions of this movie. Like, I don't know.
It doesn't know what it's doing. Yeah. From Russia with Love is definitely a D in my book. Like, Dr. No's a B, because the first two acts carry it, I think. But this is a D, and there's a lot of, like, D and F works in the James Bond series for me. Because it's when the movies don't know what the hell to do, and they just rely too much on, like, tropes and padding and filler. And this is definitely tropes and padding and filler here, to a T.
Yeah, this was a movie that should have been, like, you know, a 50-minute special on TV for Great Britain that they decided to take into the theaters and pay it up for no reason. So, whatever.
Thankfully, Goldfinger is much better, and you can see why this is often, ironically, unironically, considered the gold standard for James Bond of this era.
Well done.
I mean, I don't mean to make a pun there, but that is literally what people call this, and it is also called Goldfinger, and it's all about gold!
Yes.
He does love gold. In this one, James is an active participant, and I am very pleased about that because, you know, it is his movie, after all.
He
is enlisted to go after, almost instantly, Oryk Goldfinger, which I want to say even the Oryk is meant to say that he's gold, like the A-U. But
yes.
He is the villain. We're told from the beginning that he's the villain, and James Bond is supposed to go after him. So at multiple points, James comes in and infuriates Oryk Goldfinger, so they develop this, like, back and forth, like, villain hero kind of thing. And then Oryk comes along and, you know, gets his revenge by, like, dipping one of his ladies in gold and doing other dumb shit, which, like, why not just kill James Bond? Again, this is a thing of, you have James Bond in your sights and you decide to kill someone else instead, even though James is right there. This is something I don't get, but still. So James follows Oryk Goldfinger off to Switzerland, at where he discovers Oryk Goldfinger's gold lab, his secret military base, where secretly importing 18-karat gold and doing other evil, nefarious things, all before he travels back to Kentucky to Oryk Goldfinger's ranch, where he finds out that Oryk Goldfinger, I don't know why I keep saying his full name, but anyway, the villain decides to irradiate all the gold of Fort Knox so that it's unusable, and all the gold that Auric Goldfinger has in his own personal stash is suddenly worth a lot more. I have some weird issues with this movie. And, like, the plot itself, when you really start to think about it, doesn't make any sense. But that doesn't matter as much when all you really have is good villain versus good hero with a heist movie.
Yeah. And, no, he was a good villain.
He was a good villain.
He had Bond. He had Bond dead to rights on the laser thing right
but
on the
table. But I
appreciate
that. Because that was one of those instances where it's like, you know, after the amazing line, which is why everyone keeps quoting it, where he's like, do you expect me to talk, Goldfinger? He's like, no, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. And James Bond actually has to talk his way out of that situation because the villain lingers and waits for him to die. So I actually appreciated that. And he talks himself into a situation where Goldfinger decides to keep him alive that time. That made sense. That was good. There was a lot of good moments like that. The back and forth between them is fantastic. I think the actual heist is kind of stupid. Yeah. And it's because, okay, you've irradiated this gold. And that's his job. It's not that he wants to destroy the gold or steal it. He wants to irradiate the gold. And I'm like, so it's irradiated. They just lock it in a vault and keep it to a side. And the gold is still gold. And wait, they've already done that. It's in Fort Knox anyway. Like, what does that actually do?
I mean, it buys Auric Goldfinger a lifetime of having all the gold for himself, I suppose. Like,
but it doesn't
make a whole lot of sense.
No, governments aren't going to be like, well, this gold's irradiated. We're not going to use it. Somehow it's devalued. It's still fucking gold.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, it was. It was just weird. Like,
yeah, it was a dumb,
weird thought. Yeah.
That was one of those the few issues I had with it. For the most part, I really liked it. I thought it was pretty good. But there are certain things that you and I discussed that didn't work quite so well for me. I also noted the rear projection shots and how bad some of those really were. And it's like, I understand that all the rear projection was used so they didn't have to, like, reshoot various scenes and get filler and background for all stuff. But, like, for instance, when you see them at the poolside in Miami, when Bond is first assigned to Auric Goldfinger, and Auric sits down to play rummy with another guy and cheat him out of money, and both guys are shot against rear projection screens so they could film it in a studio and have, like, the pool shot going on behind them. I'm like, this looks terrible. It looks so bad.
It was some really bad green screen work and everything. Yeah. And I mean, is there any sore loser out there than Goldfinger too? And like, how are you going to cheat at a random rummy game poolside? Like, you can't even lose this.
You can't
game.
Even
like,
do that. You have to cheat for $1,000 when you, like, are obviously clearly rolling in millions, maybe billions in gold.
They're just setting up the girl betraying him to then, you know, have the connection with James and, I don't know, plot again, I guess.
Yep. Q shows up again in this movie, and we get the ridiculous gadgets this time around, mostly in the car. That car is over the top stupid.
Yeah, you love the Aston Martin, a staple in the franchise for James. You know, he always gets a really nice Aston Martin, and this thing had all kinds of goodies on it.
It did, but to a point that you're sitting there going, this thing would be undrivable. It would be absolutely leaded down. It would not be able to take curves. It would just be like driving a tank, basically, which is the problem when you have an armored vehicle like that. It doesn't drive well, but do we acknowledge that? No, we
can't. You know, suspend your disbelief a little bit. Enjoy that it has a smoke screen in the back and an ejector seat in the front, I guess.
I love the fact that the final Bond girl we get, because unfortunately the first two get killed. Both of
what a fake out there too, right?
Yeah, like the one girl gets killed. She gets dipped in gold paint, but still gold. And then the sister shows up and you're like, okay, she's going to be the girl. And then she dies like 5 minutes later. And you're like, but you don't even know she died. You're like, is he going to go back for her? Has she been kidnapped? And then you're like, oh, she's just dead, and the movie didn't even acknowledge it.
Yeah, it was the strangest on-screen death I think I can ever remember in a movie. Like, you don't see any blood.
Nope.
You don't see her head get cut off, I guess, because Oddjob throws his hat at her. Like, I didn't understand if she was dead at first. I didn't know what happened.
They didn't, like, there was no crack or anything to make you think that her neck broke, and her eyes were closed, which... she didn't look dead. She just looked like she was knocked out. And then they just never acknowledge her again.
Yeah.
But then we get Pussy Galore, which is a name that almost got censored in the United States, which is amazing.
I think my notes were like when she got introduced, like, "Hello, I'm Pussy Galore," and he's like, "I bet you are." James. James.
You expect her to be like, "My name is Pussy Galore," and then immediately the James Bond theme pays as he walks in, like,
and he just turns and looks like he breaks the fourth wall, just like giving the, like, the eyebrow raise, like, "I bet you are." Like,
yeah, so bad. Again, with ridiculousness, there was the model of the plane flying through the air a couple times, like, of the jet, and it was so bad looking that it was, like, it was so over the top bad that it kind of became good again, and I kind of enjoyed it for how ridiculous it was. It's like, they knew they couldn't even sell it, so they didn't even bother trying.
Yeah, there was a lot of model work going on in this movie, you know, whether it was Goldfinger's displays at his ranch or, you know, the green screen jets in the air. Like, there was a lot of models going on here in this movie.
I love the fact that once M hears that James is in the United States, he says to the CIA, "Don't rush it and spoil it. I'm sure he has it." And even though the movie makes it like James doesn't have anything under control, he eventually does. So I guess M was right.
I mean, he did have it under control to a degree, and he, you know, even the two CIA people that were there to watch him, they're like, you know, "Where's he going? Like, it seems he's on the move. It's either a dame or a drink at this point." Like, they don't even give him any credit to be kind in trouble. Like,
nope, it's kind of both, too. Another flaw with Oryx's plan is the fact that it hinges on Pussy's planes, oh my god, that sounds dirty, flying over Fort Knox and spreading gas over the base to knock out all the soldiers. And then he's going to go in and irradiate the gold. It's a very long and complicated Bond villain plan. And not only is the irradiating the gold stupid, because it's still gold, they're still going to use it, but it's also this thing of, you can't have five planes fly in formation over a military base. They would get shot down before they got even close to it. Especially when you're talking about something like Fort Knox. Like, you really think you can fly planes over that? That is a no-fly zone. Come on.
Yeah, you're not allowed within 50 miles of that one way or another unless you are military cleared. So it's it's an interesting plan again. But, I mean, you know, what Bond plan, like, villain plan isn't over the top? This one just, I mean, it's Goldfinger loving gold.
Yeah. But then, of course, the final defeat of Goldfinger is also just a little rushed because, you know, he's just, like, sucked out the plane and then they just kind of give up on it and that's that. Like, I know he's not a villain that can fight, but they kill Oddjob early enough that he doesn't have anyone else he can rely on to do the fighting for Bond. So it's like it's a three-second villain fight and then we're just like, oh, Goldfinger's gone, bye.
Yeah, we're going to touch on, you know, James before saying to Pussy Galore when she pulls the gun on him on the plane that, oh, he'll depressurize this cabin and get sucked out the window. Let's foreshadow this. And then that's how Goldfinger goes. Like,
even though that's not like, scientifically possible, but...
No, but whatever, it's fine. Hollywood magic, I suppose.
Yeah, he gets sucked out harder than an alien through a porthole. It's hilarious.
Yeah, and he's like, he goes and he gets stuck, and he's like, oh, and then, whoop, right out the window. I'm like, oh, not much drama to this, I guess. Okay.
No, I think, like, the villain plan is flawed. But I don't think it's flawed to the point that someone in 1960s would have, like, necessarily cared as much. It's playing on fears of nuclear energy and everything else, and most people weren't as in the know about how military bases worked and so forth. So I'm willing to let a lot of that slide for just being the 1960s. It is, in general, of the three so far that we've watched, the best of the Bond movies so far. Yes.
Yeah, and the intro, like, Goldfinger feels like a proper Bond song to start the movie. Mm-hmm. This really gets it where
I think
from this point forward we're gonna really have that, like, you know, that opening crawl be the song geared for the movie with somebody geared to singing it. The song Goldfinger is a good track for the movie. It feels good here.
It does.
It's good. We're getting that formula, that Bond song here.
Yeah, no, it works perfectly. I really enjoyed it. I thought all of that together was good. It has the formula. It has the vibe. It feels like a Bond film that actually understands what it needs to do. It helps that it wasn't made by Terrence, who made two of the lesser ones so far. Dr. No's fine for what it is, but it definitely falls apart. But I'm curious. He comes back for the next movie to direct the fourth one. And then the series just kind of moves on from there, which means that Thunderball and You Only Live Twice. Now, we have two ways of handling this. Do you want to watch Thunderball and You Only Live Twice, or do you want to watch Thunderball and then the remake that Sean Connery also did, Never Say Never Again?
Ooh. Yeah, I'm willing to do that. Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. It's a little weird because we're going to be taking a Sean Connery movie out of order, but it's also not an official James Bond, so I feel that's fine. And then we'll save the last of his movies for its own special podcast so we can see how he was when he came in, and then see how he was when he left the role officially.
Yeah, which sounds good.
Connery's way is weird because he left it officially, then he came back, did it one more time, then he came back and did it again. So we're doing it's a little weird here, but yeah, we'll cover that in the future. It's fine. We're gonna handle these two, and then that will be our Bond for right now. So
I think we're starting to get to that Bond that we know nowadays. The formula is starting to touch onto itself. Overall, the movie got better than the other two. You know, we're gonna start getting those fun Bond girl names: Octopussy, Pussy Galore, Fatima Blush. Like, you know, all these names that you remember. Oddjob is the first time they start bringing in like that like goofy henchman villain. So we'll see how they move throughout the rest of this with some of these other ones.
Yep. So with that, I want to once again thank our sponsor, Spectre. From the first mission to the last, Spectre is there for you. I'm Mike Finkelstein, always sitting there going, I like my gold.
And your buddy Mike the Ghoul here, gonna say, on Her Majesty's Secret Service, we will be back.
We will see you all next time.